Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Morning, Austin and Jim. I think we'll start with you this morning, Austin. You wrote a little bit about this week, but that the Mideast has basically caught on fire. And there's been a feeling that it was that mean, nasty internet video that nobody had seen and has been posted for a couple of months that caused all these problems. Was it really that mean, nasty internet video that was the catalyst for all of this?
Dan, everybody on listening to Strategy Talk can hear the irony and sarcasm in your voice. You don't believe it was that mean, nasty internet video snippet, do you? I mean, clearly you don't. What a setup question. The column I wrote was... In some ways, it's not a rewrite, but you can see elements of this column in an essay I wrote about 5 years ago, talking about how Al-Qaeda and hardcore Baathists that were their allies in Iraq would try to shake the U.S. election season in 2008. Because ever since the Tet Offensive in 1968, and I argue there are actually earlier examples of attempting to do this, but certainly the Tet Offensive during the Vietnamese New Year's and General Giap's assault on several South Vietnamese cities was a calculated military action that was meant to affect American public perception and convince a significant segment of the American public that the Vietnam War was unwinnable. Now, there were a number of people during that year that thought that was the intent of Giap's Tet offensive, and in part because the U.S. Army came back and said, hey, wait a minute, the Air Force and our artillery and some of our maneuver units just decimated the North Vietnamese Army. They lost thousands of soldiers. And now the city of Hue, which was the old Vietnamese capital, was destroyed. There was a famous line, and I know I've heard Jim use it a couple of times, we had to destroy the city in order to save it, was what some American officer said. It sounds like a flip comment. There was some truth to it, because but that's what actually Giap wanted, was to see a Vietnamese city being destroyed, a house-to-house combat with on television. He understood the television image dimension. He was an early information age warrior, as a matter of fact, and he thought that that's the way I affect American public opinion, which is the strategic fulcrum of his war in Vietnam. Now, he tells, I believe it's Morley Safer who interviews him in 1989. I think it's Morley Safer. If not, you can, somebody can go check me out on the internet. But for CBS News, he says that, look, it's nothing new to go after public opinion. He says it's always human beings. War is about human beings. And Giap was saying a heck of a lot in a couple of sentences. And other Vietnamese officers said after the war, yes, the American forces defeated us, but that's beside the point. Well, it's not really beside the point, but what it meant was that they were going after the American will to prosecute the war. Okay, that worked. That's what is meant, and to some degree, there's more to Vietnam syndrome as a media headline, but that is the strategist's component. And it also gives you a certain idea of what kind of operations you could run. Operations are going to have to get media magnification. Now, Giap was also playing off of statements by the Johnson administration and also the U.S. Vietnam commander, Westmoreland, that the light at the end of the tunnel, things are getting better. We have secured numerous hamlets and villages and towns. And actually, you could document that there were a lot of things that the Johnson administration putting out were true. But the Vietnamese army was still quite potent, and especially potent when it led by a gifted strategist like Yao. So watch it, Dan, when we have an American election year. Now, I said I was going to give you an earlier example. 1864 may be the classic example, because the South ran several operations that were designed to convince the Union voters that the war was unwinnable. One of them was Jubal Early's attack on Washington, demonstrate we still have offensive combat capability. Some historical question, you go in and study that campaign about what Early could have done, but he got very close. He got to the outskirts, and it was quite an amazing operation. Also, the bitter resistance of Grant's to Grant's attacks in 1864, and the huge casualties. You know, the casualty count was part of the South's propaganda pitch to the Union to say, look, you want to elect anybody but Lincoln. I believe McClellan was the George McClellan was the Democrat nominee in 1864, and we'll negotiate it into this, and it'll all be over. So there was an attempt there made by Americans, rebel Americans, to affect that election. So anytime you are engaged, anytime in America, the American U.S. is engaged in a conflict, watch it, especially during election years, because you can look at more recently to the 1968 example. Watch that. Now, other thing, important dates. 9/11 has become an iconic date, Dan, and that's the way I actually began the column for a lot of reasons. It's an iconic date for Americans. It's also an iconic date for militant Islamists. And by the way, I'll come back to the how do you describe a militant Islamist in a moment. There's some interesting troubles that I've seen the media have over what to call Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-inspired or Al-Qaeda like organizations. How do you distinguish it? But militant Islamists, it's the date that we took it back to America. We demonstrated our undeterrable, unstoppable, unbreakable, whatever word you want to toss in, will to counter U.S. power and influence. So if you're going to look for a date in 2012 when you could expect trouble, and I mean planned, predetermined trouble of a variety, but trouble that can do a couple of things. One, get very excitable, dramatic video imagery and crowds protesting, and then a handful of the militant Islamist elites following a good Lenin example attacking the leading an assault on the U.S. Embassy. Oh, that's a great series of images. That's gonna run on television for sure. A bomb, set off a bomb, and then provide a press release to explain why that bomb was there to end American imperialism. Find any kind of current tactical. Outrage, and that's where the video comes in. It's a tactical outrage. You can always find something, someone somewhere in the world has said that's insulting, and focus on this, because that allows the militants to portray themselves as victims. Also allows them some we are defending the honor of our the fellow Muslims. You could apply that to any other group, Dan. We are defending the honor of I'm going to be funny here, our fellow Methodists, our fellow Baptists, our fellow Episcopalians. I don't know too many other radicals in that, but you get the effect is that the elite distinguishes itself, the vanguard of the revolution, by saying that we're standing up for these insults that the rest of you are, you know, and that the insults are aimed at you, and you're being victimized by this. So you look for a tactical cover, and that video provides that. But then the Benghazi attack, that's, yes, it's being called now by the White House and State Department a terrorist attack. And you have to say, why, of course, it was well planned, but it was using a militant Islamist militia, one that's well armed. I mean, I mentioned to Jim, they're kind of like Al Shabaab, militant militia that's aligned with Al Qaeda that fights in Somalia. Al Shabaab's got mortars. Al Shabaab's got heavy machine guns, an array of anti-tank weapons. In other words, what are called heavy infantry support weapons. So did this militia, and it takes time to plan an attack that has anywhere between 100 and 400 militiamen involved. And I've seen a number of figures. By the early figures were 400. I've seen a couple of other open sources that say it's 100 to 200, but you're still talking about anywhere from a company-sized organization, about 100 men, to what's functionally a militia battalion, 400 men. It takes time to organize them, arm them, move their support weapons, divide them into mission teams. In other words, it takes leaders, commanders, and they've got to pick the target, done the intelligence work and all the other planning, and that does not happen spontaneously, Dan. And as I mentioned in the column, anybody who has made it through basic training, just made it through 5-6 months of an initial service tour, knows everything I've said to be true. You're just not moving 200, 100, 400 fighters with their heavy weapons, and it's a spontaneous combustion. It's planned, and it's not a coincidence that it happens on 9/11, or at least the evening of 9/11. Now, what we don't know at this point is if they had inside intelligence, knowing that the U.S. ambassador to Libya would be there. That would be a very important item of information to confirm or hopefully find out that they were just lucky. Maybe there was word out there that he was coming, and they were hoping to kill the ambassador. But it was certainly an assault on an American consulate, and planned to get headlines and bloody the United States. Now, what are the other goals? You know, one immediately is convince the United States this war is unwinnable. I think that that's at least part of the message by the Benghazi attack, and to a degree the simultaneous or near simultaneous demonstrations and violent incidents you see throughout the rest of the Middle East. It really didn't take more than a cell phone or an email message to coordinate some of this. Some of it could sound rather innocuous. You guys do it where you are, and we'll handle it where we are. So it's that kind of coordination to make it look like the Middle East on fire, to use your term. I'm not so sure that it is any more than it usually is, but you get the press perception. But I think one of the targets that they have are is public opinion in Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt, because they're fragile democracies, and public opinion matters. And they're demonstrating how terrorists, individuals who are going to use violence, can disrupt, not necessarily destroy, but disrupt the society. And the statement is, you're going to have to deal with us, and we're prepared to deal with you. And of course, that's a local struggle, and it gets back to what I said about how do you describe some of these radical terrorist organizations. Militant Islamists is a term that Navy Commander Abula Nine used in his book on militant Islamism that the Naval Institute Press published, I think, about 3 years ago, and we had a review up on a strategy page. And he was trying to tease out for a predominantly for a Western audience, to show the different strands of what an Islamist is. A member of the Turkish Justice and Development Party is a political Islamist, but a mainstream party and a member of NATO and the AKP is an avowed enemy of Al-Qaeda. But then you have Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of Al-Qaeda. There's actually a vast gulf between these people, and if you put the adhesive across them, Islamist, it looks like they're the same, and they're not. They're actually enemies. The government in Tunisia has the Ennahda Party, which is the political Islamist party there in Tunisia, has tried to make this clear to diplomatically. So one of the terms that the army and the U.S. military suggested several years ago was a Salafist, a militant who's committed to being an original follower of Muhammad, and that's you see Al-Qaeda often described as a Salafist movement. That hasn't stuck, but it's certainly it was a briefing I attended in the gutter at CENTCOM headquarters in 2005, where the briefing officer addressing this issue of how do you tell the difference between a Muslim moderate, and I happen to be a Muslim, like this, and a political Islamist and a militant Islamist, and he was saying we've used Salafist. We think that's a useful term, but I think that's 7 years ago, and it obviously hasn't made it. It may be time to drag that out, or just call them the Al-Qaeda. And even though Al-Qaeda is as a organization, with the Al-Qaeda that existed in September of 2001, no longer really exists. It's damaged. As an idea, Al-Qaeda is something like a hydra. And that makes a statement about a absolute militant, violent, vicious terrorist organization that is not interested in democracy, is interested in a religious dictatorship. So, anyway, that's, I think, it's been an exciting 8, 9, 10 days, Dan, and I think all that's we've seen acted out in since September 11th.
Right. Jim?
The problem in the Middle East goes pretty deep. We've mentioned many times the Arab Reform Movement, which is sponsored by many people, including the King of Saudi Arabia. A lot of Arabs are aware that they are in a bad situation. And certainly Strategy Page has covered a lot of the bad things the Arabs are concerned about. One thing that never gets covered in any detail is the fact that the Arab world hasn't really done much in the last, 500-600 years. Some say 1,000. And again, something that is a known fact, historians have been talking about this for centuries, is that Islam hit a wall 1,000 years ago between the reformers or the liberals, whatever you want to call them, the people who were translating all the old Greek and Roman and other, ancient texts into Arabic, and that eventually got over into Europe, versus the Islamic fundamentalists. Sound familiar? Well, yeah. The fundamentalists won. Now, they didn't win completely. They were continually pushed back, but they were always there, and they've never gone away. And that's what we're fighting right now. That's why you have such little economic progress in the Arab world. I mean, it's pathetic, the figures. I mean, they're out there. The Arabs certainly don't like to publicize them. But, the amount of, the educational attainment, economic attainment, lack of democracy, violence, treatment of women and children for that matter, ghastly, you know, compared to the West or even many, you know, non-industrialized countries. And this gives you a pool of angry young men. They've always been there for all sorts of causes, not necessarily Arab, you know, radicalism. The big change, you know, in the 80s and 90s was, you know, bin Laden and his friends, as it were, deciding that, you know, the problem isn't in the Middle East, which is ridiculous. I mean, nobody in the Middle East will agree with that. The Salafist doctrine basically holds that a pure Muslim, you know, there was a Muslim who lives, you know, in a medieval way, you know, follows all the rules, is pure and, you know, beyond reproach. So anything bad that's happening to him isn't his fault. You know, the fact that you, you won't educate women, you won't teach your kids science or much of anything, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that has nothing to do with it. It must be external forces. For a long time, it was the Turks. Now, the Turks' response to that was firing squads and hanging a lot of people. So the Arabs quieted down for a long time. But they found out the West responded in a different way. You know, you can play on Western guilt, whether it's justified or not. If you pull the right strings, you get a favorable response. And as Austin was pointing out, the Arabs, especially Al-Qaeda, has learned to play that very well. But the fundamental problems are still there. And as long as the fundamentals are not changed, and many Arabs are trying to change them, but it's slow going because they've never solved the fundamental religious problem. I mean, Europe went through its religious wars, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. And there were still some skirmishes, but the fundamentals were changed, you know, with the rise of Protestantism, you know, the several waves of reforms in the Catholic Church, et cetera, et cetera. There are no longer these massive, you know, slaughters in the name of, you know, which way you should be praying or not. Indeed, some of my ancestors were Huguenots fleeing, you know, the revival of religious warfare in late, 17th century France. So it's something that still resonates in the West, but it no longer plays a major part in the West. That's not the situation, in the Arab world. And until that is solved, you know, it's going to be like Groundhog Day. We're just going to keep going through the same motions again and again and again until, you know, the machine, as it were, that creates all this bad news, is changed. And, you know, that's what people have to concentrate on, and it's hard to because it's not politically correct to talk about mucking about with somebody else's culture. But, you know, if the culture is killing you, what choice do you have?
Right. Well, Austin, how long is what's going on right now in the Middle East? I mean, will these riots and everything settle down here in a week or two, or what's going to be the result of all this?
You know, it's tough to predict. Will some of them continue? Yes, because again, you're reflecting domestic issues that are unsettled. And just to give you one frame on it, Dan, I've said this on Strategy Talk before. I've said it in a couple of radio programs I've been on. I think I've said it in a couple of columns I've written. We're not going to know the results of Arab Spring for another 30 or 40 years. Matter of fact, I think I said that on C-SPAN last fall. Yeah. And so that's part of the, on the daily or hourly level, the turmoil. And Jim just gave you some, you know, 5, 6, 7, arguably 8 centuries worth of reasons to see the to bring us where we are today. A radical, even an unarmed radical, who wants to make trouble, is going to make trouble, and you're going to get cameras. And we live in a world now, Dan, where everybody with a cell phone that has video capacity works for the BBC. So it's possible that that comes back to your internet video snippet. Anybody can reach the internet with a statement of video imagery. Now, an armed radical, and armed with just a pistol, he can be Gavril Princip and shoot an archduke, but an armed radical is going to get headlines, public danger, and you can create a mess with one pistol. Certainly you can create a mess with one grenade, and there are a lot of grenades in Libya. There are not so many in Tunisia. Not so many in Egypt right now, but you can find them, and there are plenty of the weapons they're all over among the radicals. Radicals can always get a weapon. The state does not have control of violence in Libya. And really doesn't in Tunisia, even though the Tunisian army has really been a stalwart in the terms of maintaining domestic security. The situation in Egypt is extremely unsettled. Mohamed Morsi, the president, fired the chief of staff, 6 weeks or so ago, and then I noticed quietly a few days afterwards he gave him an award or some sort of a recognition. The relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the dominant party in the Egyptian government right now, and the Egyptian military is adversarial. And there's parts of it are adversarial. Some of the places it's worse. It's an outright low-grade civil war between them. And you'll see that. And these are not directed at the United States. Now, for a propagandist, a radical propagandist, it's always convenient to aim it at the United States or Israel. In some places, France. In some places, Great Britain. The West in general, because that plays to the victimization narrative. Also picks up on 70 years of commie propaganda about the imperialists. There was no bigger imperialist than the Russians, with the Soviet Empire, but that was force-fed by the Moscow for decades, and you certainly saw at least the secular arm of the Palestinian rebel movement was aligned with that line of Soviet propaganda. There are a lot of interesting connections between radical Islamic anti-American propaganda and Soviet propaganda, and for that matter, Nazi anti-American propaganda from World War II, what the Hitler's propagandists ginned up to tar the United States. And so they'll use that, and yet at the same time, what their connection is that their domestic opponents are therefore the puppets of the United States. I will add one other thing, too. The situation in Egypt, it's extremely tough to call because there's a lot. Mohamed Morsi has a lot he needs to do in the next 3 or 4 months. It's probably better if he does it quietly in terms of taking security steps to deal with the radicals. That way you won't hear about it in the U.S. press. You won't hear about it. You'll hear the screams from the Al-Qaeda and the militants. If he doesn't do that, though, then you're going to learn something about his long-term inclinations. It's definitely not good for U.S. policy. My bet right now is that we'll have this quiet civil war waged by the Egyptian government against the radicals, and then the radicals will be the militants will turn and say, "See, Morsi really wasn't one of us. He's Mubarak who hangs out at the mosque. That's all." So that's a scenario, and it's certainly something to think about. I'd be interested in hearing Jim's take on what Morsi's options are.
Jim?
Well, he's got to become fairly moderate and economy-friendly real fast because the revolution and the collapse of Mubarak's support system, in other words, all the industrialists and corrupt businessmen whom Mubarak had made rich and who had in turn made Mubarak rich, went into paralysis. Tourists stayed away in droves, And basically, people are, if you ask people, are you better off now than you were under Mubarak? Well, most people will say, well, no, we're not. And it's true. And all the promises the Muslim Brotherhood has made don't mean much if more people are out of work or, you know, making a lot less money. So, and he's been trying to do this. You can see him backpedaling as fast as he can. He doesn't want to get too many of the radicals in his own group, you know, the Muslim, the Muslim Brotherhood reformers, shall we say, angry. But, you know, if you don't have enough people, they are politicians willing to face reality. And they're always, in the Middle East especially, there are always a lot of politicians who don't want to be bothered with reality. Give me a good revolution, you know, give me a good, you know, soundbite, whatever, you know, screw the real world. If he doesn't have enough people behind him to basically get the economy going again, and they're not going to do that with speeches and, you know, posturing, then he's going to be gone. The Mubarak fraud is still there. They're biding their time. They're hoping that Morsi makes a complete, you know, mess of it. They will slowly, a lot of them are still in power. They, all of a sudden, you'll get somebody, you know, with a Mubarak connections, running for president. They've done this, already tried this, running for president and winning. And that'll be the end of, you know, the new dawn with the Muslim Brotherhood. Gotta watch out for reality. It will bite you in the ass if you're not careful.
Yeah, for a minute there, Jim, I thought you were talking about our administration here when you said speeches and like that would not get the economy.
Oh, no, these are universal truths. No, they appeal everywhere. You know, a lot of people are saying, do you want to end up like Greece? And actually, that could be, could have been said of the ancient Persian Empire. I'm not going to digress into that. But let me tell you, all those problems have been around for thousands of years. And it's all in the written record. So, you know, all this is nothing new. Either you get in touch with reality or you're in big trouble.
Well, there was a reason that Gibbons wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Yes, right? Because it was an old story. It's told again on a grand scale.
Right, and it had application again and again.
Exactly. Well, in his own time, we're talking about 200 years ago. You know, it, as the old saying goes, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it paraphrases itself wonderfully.
All right. Well, I think if the fires don't continue the burn in the Middle East, the embers will continue to glow and flame up here over and over again for, like Austin said, the next 40 years or more. So
it's unsettled, and I put that out there just to give people a feeling of that. The next headline may be interesting and frightening, but it ain't the end of it.
Right.
It's just the next headline.
Yep. And we just need to be ready for that. And we can't think that things are solved just because we give a speech in Egypt.
Or think that everything's lost either. I mean, there's a pessimism, pessimism component as well, in part because of that, convincing somebody that it's unwinnable is an example of the pessimism.
Okay. Right.
So,
well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time. Thank you.
Bye. Indeed. Till then. Bye-bye.